I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The economy is officially shrinking, and that recession people keep talking about, well, there's disagreement as to whether or not we're already in it, but now some economists are saying they expect it will last longer and be more painful than originally thought. The government today reports that gross domestic product was down 0.3% last quarter, one of the main reasons people just aren't spending as much money, with the biggest drop in personal consumption since 1980. Housing construction is also down, and unemployment figures are a bit higher. It sounds pretty glum, and Nigel Gall, chief U.S. economist at the forecasting firm Global Insight, says it's actually even worse. He joins us now. Nigel, worse? Why?
Well, the headline GDP minus 0.3 doesn't look too bad, but as you've noted, consumption expenditure was plunging, housing construction was falling, business equipment spending was falling. Everything on the private sector side, U.S. private spending, everything was down pretty sharply. We were propped up partly by a very big quarter for federal defense spending. That added almost a percentage point to growth. We're not going to get that every quarter.
Oh, so you're saying that actually the numbers are worse because, you know, that included in these numbers are defense spending.
Yep. And defense spending was up very, very sharply. But the underlying health of the economy is driven by the private sector, not by a temporary jump in federal defense spending. If we also look at what happened to exports were still growing, not growing as much as in previous quarters, but still growing. So the foreign economy, the rest of the world was still helping us. Well, we know the rest of the world is also tipping into recession, so we're not going to have that support from exports there in subsequent quarters.
Well, there's that recession word. I only want to spend a second on this because it's kind of infuriating because, you know, some people say we're in it, some people say we're not. Some people hold to the classic definition of a recession as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. We're reporting one today, but the last one wasn't negative, but the one before that was. So what is your sense if this is officially a recession?
It hasn't yet been officially declared to be a recession. There is a committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research which will declare it a recession. At the moment, they haven't met to do that. But your listeners are going to think that I'm completely mad if I don't say we're in recession. Of course we're in recession. Everybody knows it.
And how do we know it? I mean, for those who haven't foreclosed or haven't, you know, had their credit cut off, how do they feel it?
They feel it because they're worried about losing their job, or maybe they know somebody who has lost their job. They can see that the unemployment rate is going up. They can see that their incomes are in much worse shape than they were a year ago. They can read layoff announcements pretty much every day in the press. It's all around us.
One of the definitions of a recession is when someone you know loses a job, as you just said, as opposed to a depression when you lose your job.
Exactly.
That's, you know, aside, though. Well, we are also hearing new reports of how this is spreading throughout different sectors. Credit card companies are beginning to cut back on credit limits and raise interest rates or even cancel cards. And we're approaching the holiday season. Talk for a second about credit cards.
Well, what has happened is that consumers a couple of years ago were relying very much on borrowing against the value of their homes to support their spending. That's become increasingly impossible because credit's been pulled back there and also because the value of homes has been falling. So consumers have tended to fall back onto other consumer loans and also onto their credit cards to support their level of spending, try to maintain their standard of living, and of course now they're going to get into difficulty on those particular debts. So it means that banks are going to pull back very sharply. They're running away from risk as fast as they can. And if you like that sort of last support that consumers have been falling back on to support spending, that's going to be shut off. So we see further declines in consumer spending ahead.
The Federal Reserve yesterday cut a key interest rate to 1%. This is, I believe, the rate that banks use to lend money to each other, speaking of banks. And some are speculating that that rate could go as low as zero. What does that mean?
If it goes to zero, the main message that's sending is that we are in very, very big trouble, because it's telling us that the Fed is having to do everything it can to try to pump liquidity into the system, to try to persuade banks to lend to each other and to lend to consumers at a time when they're clearly very, very reluctant to do so. So if the Fed goes down all the way to zero, it's signaling that the financial system is totally clogged up. The Fed's doing all it can to try to unclog financial flows, But going to zero is a message that the economy is in for a very steep recession.
And it also means there's nowhere else to go. Nigel Gull, do we just have a minute left here? I know you're an analyst as opposed to an advisor, but what's the takeaway here? What does this mean for people? What should they do?
Well, it means that over the next, over the next 6 months, we're in for a very tough time. We're going to be seeing, the unemployment rate moving up quite sharply. A lot of people at risk of losing their jobs. It's difficult to give people advice other than to hunker down to the extent that they can, bolster their savings. Of course, everybody does that. It takes the economy down.
Right.
But for an individual, that really is the best thing you can do, try to guard against the worst outcome.
Yeah, because savings are always the best idea. But if you're not spending, you're contributing to the recession that we may or may not be in. Nigel Gault, Chief U.S. Economist for the forecasting firm Global Insight. Nigel, thanks as always.
Okay, thank you.
Well, more than a million homes have already been lost to foreclosure in the last 2 years, and undoubtedly there are more ahead. Ryan Chittum is a business writer for the Columbia Journalism Review, and as such, he's reported on foreclosures. But as a young person, he went through one, and he wrote about that recently in the review as well. It's quite a story that got quite a response, and we want to spend some time on that today. Ryan joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Ryan, let's start at the beginning. You were 15. This was in the 90s when this happened. Can you describe your family situation before the foreclosure?
Well, my folks were blue collar. My dad worked a graveyard shift at a grocery store, and in the daytime he laid carpet. And my mom worked in the cafeteria of my school so she could be home when we got home. We lived in South Tulsa, in a three-bedroom house on a big lot. We weren't rich by any means, but we went on vacation every year and, had this sort of, decent middle-class Americana lifestyle.
Your dad, laying carpet during the day, came across a lot of fumes and got sick.
Yeah. He'd been a workaholic all his life, working 70, 80 hours a week. I mean, just all the time. And then I started to realize that he'd been sick for a while and hadn't worked. And I remember asking my mom what was going on, and they didn't know. And he was pretty much laid up for weeks and weeks, and went to the doctors, and they couldn't tell him what was wrong. And this turned into a couple-year ordeal where he was basically unable to work, and sometimes even to get out of bed.
Well, as your dad got sicker, of course, the financial problems started mounting up. His workman's compensation ran out. Your parents ran through their savings, which was just $10,000, including retirement,
right,
from 17 years at Skaggs. They started getting behind on their house payments. Now, what kind of mortgage did they have at that point?
They had a traditional 30-year fixed-rate mortgage.
Right.
This was in the mid-'80s, I think, when they got it. Interest rates were high at that time. I think 13%, I think, was what theirs was.
Right. And so their mortgage had no funny business. It was just your plain old mortgage with $800 monthly payments, but they started to fall behind. At this point, you and your sister are qualifying for free lunches. Your family went on food stamps. Describe, by the way, your family's reaction to being on food stamps, because your parents were conservative Republicans. How did your mom react to that?
Well, it was... They were ashamed. Their philosophy and how I was raised and how their parents raised them was that if you work hard in America, you will be fine. You'll get ahead. Things will work out for you. And they're, it just didn't take into account that you might not be able to work.
It wasn't that easy on you as a teenager either. I mean, you write about how you just used to go stand in the parking lot. You didn't want to see it.
Right. Well, I can remember when we first got food stamps, and I knew at a young age that this was embarrassing. And we went through the grocery store. It happened to be one that my dad had worked at before, and I can remember the first time that we went through the line, and my mom had to use the food stamps, and she just started crying at the checkout. And I learned pretty quickly that it was easier for me that when we got to the checkout line, I just went to the parking lot or the camera bar up front and just avoided the whole scene because I was so embarrassed. It's something that makes me feel terrible today, abandoning my mother at the time. But, it's a really hard thing to deal with, and not just as a kid, obviously as my mom showed as an adult. Yeah.
Well, creditors are calling. Your dad spending hours on the phone with them, even though he was disabled, he can't work. He has no way of paying them. At a certain point, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, gets involved. By the way, what did they do? Did they renegotiate the mortgage payments? How did they help out?
It was a program that lowered the payment for a couple years down to $68 a month, which was about all they could afford. You know, my mom was making $7,000, $8,000 a year in the cafeteria and couldn't quit to look for another job and didn't have a college, you know, degree. So she was kind of stuck there. And I just lost my train of thought.
No, that's okay. This is tough to talk about, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to, you know, writing that piece was, it was like pulling my teeth on myself or something. It was, I hated every minute of it. I had my editor, Dean Starkman, kept encouraging me to do it. I didn't know if I should do it. Well, he thought that it was a useful story for others in the business press to read.
Well, tell us a little more about that. Let's switch to that. That may be even easier, actually. So why did you do this? What, you know, given that it was so hard, why did you tell this story?
I was talking to Dean about foreclosures and how we just didn't think that the tenor of the coverage had been right. There was something missing about the misery of, you know, what millions of people are going through now. And so, you know, I told him, I've been through this. And this is something that I had spent years trying to cover up. You know, when I was in school, I didn't want to be the poor kid. I didn't have the best clothes. I didn't, you know, I was eating the free lunch. And so pulling it out was difficult. But he said, you know, I think you need to do it. And I came to agree with him just because, you know, there's a long history in media criticism of noting how journalists, especially in the last 35 years or so, don't come from this, you know, the same class as the vast majority of Americans, I think. And this isn't to say that reporters who have lost a home can't cover this with empathy and with enough power. But, you know, the crisis has swelled and it's the focus is on Wall Street at this particular moment, rightly so. But we've got to remember that the cavity at the heart of this is people losing their houses. When you hear a million people losing their houses, your eyes glaze over, but 90% of them, I'd say, some of these were speculators, of course, but 90% of them are people sort of like me that lost their house. You know, they've got kids, they've got whatever, and it's a really difficult thing to do, and it sets you back in your life several years.
Well, eventually, Ryan's family was evicted. That's Ryan Chittum, business writer for the Columbia Journalism Review, who wrote recently about the foreclosure of his family's home when he was 15. In a minute, we'll hear how his parents got back on their feet, but incredibly got into another mortgage down the road and through a nefarious agent found themselves with interest rates that shot up. We'll hear about that and about how Ryan's readers reacted to his story. Later today, also Election Day, still several days away, but the candidates' transition teams are already hard at work, as we'll hear. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Ryan Chittum, business writer for the Columbia Journalism Review, who writes about foreclosures and went through one as a teen when his dad became sick and could no longer work. After the family lost their home in 93, they moved to a duplex, but his dad got sicker, and then they moved to an apartment in a pretty rough complex. So, Ryan, what was that like for a kid being evicted?
Well, it was just this sort of, you know, my whole life had been relatively secure. I'd felt this feeling. You don't know that you've felt secure until you lose that sense of security. And I think that's what it was. We were on the edge and were able to stay in that house for, you know, a few years because of the safety net program. But it was something that still affects us today.
Well, you say it's like a piece missing or something. It's like a piece of your self-esteem missing.
Right. And, you know, at a critical time, you know, I was 15 and a half when we lost the house. And that's a difficult age, you know, going through high school and peer pressure. And so to have this, you know, your home is, your castle is a cliche, but it's true. And when the walls have been breached, I never felt nearly as safe and secure of my place and my family's place in the world.
Well, you write that it colored your worldview ever since, and you became a business writer. A shrink would maybe have a field day with that.
Yeah. it was accidental, trust me. I didn't intend to do it.
Your sister is doing well as well. Your parents did get back on their feet eventually. Your dad became a truck driver. Then incredibly, in 2001, just a few years ago, now they're older now, they did purchase another home with a conventional fixed mortgage. And then they went to refinance. Now you, the business, you know, budding business writer, you tell them, don't get an adjustable rate mortgage. It's going to shoot up at some point. They say, don't worry, we didn't. Then what?
Well, I'd always tried to give them, advice when I was a kid, and of course they never listened to me. Once I became a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, they tended to take my financial advice more seriously, and I told them, don't get an adjustable rate mortgage. And there's a lot of chicanery going on out there. And they got a loan, and unbeknownst to them, the mortgage broker had put them in an arm with a prepayment penalty if they sold within 4 years. So when they went to move out of town, and they told me that that they had gotten, you know, this arm and this prepayment penalty, I was furious at them, but they told me they didn't know. They had specifically said that they didn't want anything like that and had gotten put into it. And my folks, they're not financial experts, they're not lawyers, but they're not stupid people, you know. But this happened to them. Up until then, I covered commercial real estate at the Journal. I didn't cover housing directly, but it's kind of a cousin. So, you know, I touched on it a little bit. But it was a little bit hard for me to believe that people got put into these things unbeknownst to them, that the mortgage industry was really as corrupt as it had gotten. My dad has been self-employed most of his life, and he does business on a handshake, and I think he's trusted people too much, and I think that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, they had to structure a lease purchase agreement with a buyer so that they wouldn't have to pay that big prepayment penalty.
And we're hoping that the lease purchaser will come through on his end of the deal, because when they signed this, the market wasn't quite as bad off as it is now.
Well, so now you're telling your family's whole tale. What do you think of some of the reaction that you've gotten? People, while often seeming, to be kind to you and your story, don't seem to be buying your theory that your family represents other families that have gone into foreclosure. Here's a comment from Carl. He writes, Ryan, as touching as your story was, and I say that with no sarcasm, we all know that most people facing foreclosure now are in the position they're in because of bad choices, not as in your father's first case, bad luck, you know, with his health. And here's Ed. He writes about the last mortgage that your family found themselves in with the arm, you know, the adjustable rate. Come on now. They signed the house purchase documents and didn't know they had an arm. I find this very difficult to believe. Mind you, these were not novice home buyers and had been through the process once before. I've had enough of the unscrupulous mortgage broker's story. The truth is there were willing buyers who took advantage of the system. Sure, they now say they were bilked, but as anyone who goes through a settlement knows, everything is explained in excruciating detail. What do you say? I mean, people, you know, some of us may have been touched by your story, but it seems like a lot of people got angry. What's your thought about that?
There is a lot of anger, and it's been building for a long time, and I don't think it's inappropriate anger. I think that there are a lot of people out there that did make bad choices.
Living above their means?
Living above their means, but everybody wanted to get in on the act. You know, housing prices were going up, you know, and there was not an insignificant amount of speculation.
The flippers,
and nobody has a sympathy for their speculators. But as much as people might want to believe because they themselves had an honest mortgage broker, and I think most mortgage brokers are honest, but if you have 10% say there aren't, that's a big deal. A lot of these loans, we know people were refinanced or put into loans that they couldn't afford unbeknownst to them. Most people aren't hiring lawyers to help them close a house. Now, I expected that when I wrote this piece. It was part of why it was such a cringeworthy experience for me to write it. People who did things right and aren't in trouble, when other people get bailed out, you know, I think there's a natural tendency to react against that. But I think we just can't forget that not only, and I hate to be, you know, maudlin or whatever, but, you know, through my experience, there's lots of kids involved. You know, they didn't they didn't do this, and they're going to have to go through this. And it also has policy implications because this sort of populist anger at fellow citizens means that with the current bailout plan, the administration hasn't felt as much pressure as it probably should to help out homeowners while they're handing out trillions of dollars to Wall Street. I think, you know, there needs to be something done about the housing situation. I don't know what it is, but this sort of reaction, I think, plays into politicians' ability to sidestep the issue.
Ryan Chittum, business writer for the Columbia Journalism Review, who wrote about the foreclosure of his own home when he was 15. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And there is news today from policymakers. A plan is reportedly in the works to give as many as 3 million homeowners more affordable mortgages. The Treasury Department and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation are designing a program which would readjust some mortgages, lengthening them so that the monthly payments would be decreased. One caveat, a federal official tells Time.com, not everyone at risk of losing their home will be helped. There are foreclosures that will go forward. Okay, after the news. Well, how about those Phillies here and now? Both Barack Obama and John McCain are focused on Election Day, November 4th, but behind the scenes they have their eyes on November 5th. More than ever in this post-9/11 world, the presidential campaigns are working on transitioning into office, and with an economic crisis and two active wars, at least one scholar says this may be the most important transition since Lincoln's. Let's start our look at transitions with Martha Joynt Kumar, professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland and director of the White House Transition Project, a nonpartisan group that works with transition teams for both candidates. And Martha, you've been called the institutional memory of the presidency in transition. The 9/11 Commission pointed out that transitions were a time of vulnerability for the nation, and Commission members were critical of the Bush transition. The model for most scholars is the Reagan transition. What did they get right?
The Reagan transition was one that started early with Governor Reagan identifying Pendleton James as a person who was a specialist in appointments. He was a headhunter, and he was brought in the spring of 1980, and he worked with Ed Meese, who was with the campaign, and the two of them coordinated. So you had a really good operation. And then they brought in a large number of task forces, which in retrospect a lot of people thought caused them more trouble than the benefit. But where they benefited was during the campaign, Reagan identified key issues that he had been talking about for years: privatization, cutting the number of people in government. And when he came in, people knew what he was going to do, what his priorities would be. The economy was in poor shape at the time, both high unemployment and high inflation. So what he did was focus on the economy and told everyone within his administration that that was going to be his priority, and he would only deal with issues that related to that. So he gave a major address to the Congress in mid-February. All of his appointments that he focused early on dealt with the economy. They isolated 87 positions that they thought were going to be key to turning the economy around. And I think you're going to see that again in this administration.
That's Martha Joynt Kumar, director of the nonpartisan White House Transition Project. Martha, thank you. So there are 3,000 full-time posts to fill, another 7,000 appointments for boards and commissions. It takes about 800 people to work on a transition. So what are the campaigns doing? We turned out to Los Angeles Times reporter Tom Hamburger. And Tom, we just heard Professor Kumar talking about the highly successful Reagan transition. What are we hearing from both campaigns about this transition?
We are hearing the Reagan administration described as a model transition from both the historians like your guest who just spoke and from people in the Obama campaign and the Obama organization who say, in fact, the Reagan transition is serving as something of a model for us, and it's a model in a couple of different ways.
Well, tell us some, because we understand, first of all, that Reagan relied on a newly formed Heritage Foundation.
The Heritage Foundation provided a place for scholars to reside, research to be conducted, and plans to be laid that were supported by private foundations. It was a place for scholars and conservatives to land and to actively plan the transition. Similarly, in this case, we see another foundation. This time it's a foundation funded from the left and with scholars largely from the left, the Center for American Progress, that is going to provide a sort of intellectual network for the Obama transition.
Well, let's talk about Obama first. By all press accounts, the Obama camp is further into the planning. Reportedly, there's a 50-chapter document soon to be published as a book. It was put together, though, ironically, by Clinton backers?
Well, the guy who's in charge of the Obama transition, at least at this point, John Podesta, Bill Clinton's former chief of staff, has been the head of the Center for American Progress. And one of the things that he decided, wisely, historians say, over a year ago, was to put together a project, which he called The Blueprint, a 50-chapter book on how the next president should organize a transition into office. And although the Center for American Progress said, we'll make this a book available to whomever wins, Republican or Democrat, it was widely thought through the early part of 2008 that this book was being prepared by Hillary Clinton backers for Hillary Clinton should she become the next president. But in fact, the guy who led this blueprint project, John Podesta, is now running Barack Obama's transition. And many of the chapters in this book have been written by high-profile former Clinton White House staffers, including John Podesta, who wrote the chapter on the executive office of the president.
And John McCain's camp has criticized the Obama campaign, saying, you know, they've already measured the drapes. We've heard that. Rick Davis, campaign manager, says it's not in McCain's nature to tempt fate, you know, by getting too assuming about planning for the future. But every presidential candidate has to plan for this transition. So where is McCain on this?
This is reading tea leaves to a certain extent, but one of the things that we can tell, and both campaigns have confirmed this, is that the Obama campaign, as we've seen the campaign run in other areas as well, is being more systematic, has a clearer plan, they're keeping to it, and the McCain campaign also has a transition operation underway. It is not as sophisticated or as detailed as the Obama transition, but it is in place.
Well, and who's heading up McCain's transition team?
Former Navy Secretary John Layman. There are others who are helping with that team. In fact, both campaigns have sent representatives to the White House to discuss transition and also to present names for security clearances post 9/11. Both campaigns are concerned about, and the current White House is concerned about, expediting security clearances for personnel that would have to deal with defense and national security needs. The next president is going to have to deal with foreign policy issues and an economic crisis. We've heard from both campaigns that as they look to the transition, they're doing some extra thinking and putting together teams to consider economic remedies and how to respond to the economic crisis.
Do we have names? I mean, I know both campaigns would deny, but what are some of the names that are floating out there?
Again, we know a little more about the Obama campaign. And what we're hearing now is that some of the Clinton administration top economic advisors, from Robert Rubin to Larry Summers to Gene Sperling, who is in the Clinton White House as an economic advisor, have been talking and working with the transition team. And there have been rumors about a Treasury Secretary, maybe Timothy Geithner, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. On the McCain side, we're hearing Robert Zoellick, the president of the president of the World Bank. There are also some other Wall Street names that have surfaced. The Mayor Bloomberg of New York, we've heard that name mentioned.
John Thain's name's been raised for a possible McCain appointment. And also Joe Lieberman, to head the Pentagon or the State Department.
And both campaigns have suggested Defense Secretary Gates as someone who might be held over. Again, there's no confirmation there.
Well, and if you run a business and you think you have it rough when there's an opening and you get resumes, whoever wins, the administration will be sifting through 75,000 applications in the first few months. So they've got their work cut out for them.
Yes.
Tom Hamburger, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Robin. Good to talk to you.
And before the transition, there is Election Day tomorrow. What could go wrong? Well, don't wear a T-shirt with a candidate's name on it. If you want to vote in Virginia, you'll be turned away. And don't leave any polling place without casting at least a provisional ballot. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at voting. You're listening to Here and Now.
Thank you.
What can a computer game tell us about the presidential election? As it turns out, a lot. A computer game called The Political Machine lets you run for president, or you can run as Lincoln, or as John McCain, or Barack Obama. And 4 years ago, the game predicted the outcome of the election, down to the key state, Ohio. Scott Tykosky is the executive producer of The Political Machine. Scott, I've got your game up on a computer here. How does it work?
Basically, we try to make politics as fun as possible. When you put things into a game format, you want to make sure that they're accessible. So you'll notice that all the candidates are little bobbleheads. You're flying around in a big cartoon airplane. And you're basically going around from state to state, raising your awareness, getting people to know about you, getting people to know about your stance on the issues, and trying to win on election night.
Well, I'm on a page now which tells us a little more how we can do this. You select your candidate, but then you can create ads to tailor to the most important issues. You can use political operatives and endorsements to pump up your campaign. And, you know, somebody might play it sort of fancifully, but you actually do this with real information.
Yeah, we try to put all the accurate facts in there. So we can reasonably say, based on the facts and the data and the proper mathematical calculations, this is who we believe is going to come out on top on election night.
What's the game showing now? Who's leading?
We try to run our presidential outcome mode when there are large events. When the VPs got picked, we ran it again. 3 weeks ago, we ran it, and it came down to Colorado. Basically, whoever won Colorado was going to come out on top. Lately, things have been going a little bit more in Obama's favor, and we're finding that no matter what we do, the game keeps on pumping out lately an Obama win. There's so much fluctuation and so many variables that it has been. It's been a trying experience coming up with the right mathematical equation that predicts it, but we hope that with all that correct data and when everything's said and done, it's going to be a pretty accurate representation of election night.
That's Scott Tykosky, executive producer of The Political Machine, an online election game. Scott, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
And we have to note that for the first time since 1980, the second time in the team's history, and in maybe one of the longest World Series games ever, given that it stretched over 3 days, the Philadelphia Phillies have been crowned champions of Major League Baseball, beating the Tampa Bay Rays 4-1 after last night's win in Philly. Al Morganti is with Sports Radio 610 WIPA in Philadelphia. That's how they say it there. Al, your thoughts today?
Well, it's just unbelievable. The fifth game went on forever, it seemed like, and it's like it was written poetically. It was all condensed into like 3 innings because of the ridiculous rain delay that went on forever.
Right.
There were lead changes. A closer that was perfect through the season came on and finished his postseason perfect. And then you could hear the champagne corks popping. I mean, the city, everybody was waiting to just explode, and then Lidge provided the third strike. The city just literally lit up.
Well, and you've got a big parade tomorrow. A million fans expected to turn out. The city's first victory celebration since the 76ers won the NBA title back in 1983. Boy, that, you know, that has been a drought despite the rain delay. It has been a drought for Philadelphia.
And I will say that the Phillies were willing to carry that on their shoulders for all the franchises, which sometimes isn't fair. But they knew how much everybody just wanted to celebrate here. And this parade, I mean, it's going to be sensational weather. It's a Friday. It's Halloween. And that's all we've heard about here is we want a parade, we want a parade, we want a parade. And this thing here is going to be gargantuan.
Well, I just want to ask you, you mentioned Lidge. Brad Lidge struck out the last Tampa Bay player, fell to his knees, at which point he was tackled by, I think, half of the city.
Ryan Howard, the biggest guy on the team, came in. Lidge went to his knees. At least he had some kind of a three-point stance or whatever with his with his fist on the ground to try to, because that was a, he really.
Is he okay?
After the game, he was absolutely fine. And it was a great, great celebration. It's one of those things where, you know, sometimes it's a pretty shaky gospel that sports brings people together, but I'll tell you, this brought everybody together, and it's so much fun to be in a city where everybody's on the same page.
Well, we know it occasionally here in Boston. Al, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And congratulations again.
Thank you.
Al Morganti of the Morning Team at Sports Radio 610 WIP in Philadelphia. This is for our Philly listeners. And when we come back, the sequel to the award-winning book for young people, Octavian Nothing. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. When we last saw our hero, he was fleeing across the mudflats outside Boston, looking to join the King's Men to fight the colonists. I'm referring, of course, to Octavian Nothing, the subject of M.T. Anderson's National Book Award-winning novel, The Astonishing Life of Octavian Nothing, Traitor to the Nation. Raised by the Novanglian College of Lucidity, a mysterious group of Boston scientists who schooled Octavian and treated him like a prince, Octavian only gradually learns that he is actually the subject of an experiment to see if Africans can learn as well as Europeans. The reader also slowly discovers that Octavian is living in pre-revolutionary war Boston, and after becoming aware of his actual lowly status as an actual slave, he flees the house of the scientists, and after a series of misadventures, he and his tutor stage a rebellion of their own. And that was just book one. Now the follow-up, Octavian Nothing, Kingdom on the Waves. And joining us in the studio is M.T. Anderson, who goes by Tobin. Tobin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You told us last time this was coming.
I warned you.
The follow-up. Now, in the first book, so much was based on real history. For instance, there's a phantasmagoric smallpox party that upper-class Bostonians go to try to get smallpox, and some of them die. I mean, just really odd, but you know, you told us, well, this was based in fact. And the new book is based in fact as well as Octavian joins who in fighting?
Well, he eventually in this book joins Lord Dunmore's Royal Ethiopian Regiment, and that is actually a real regiment that was formed in the period, and the history of it played out pretty much exactly as I talk about in the book. Yeah. Lord Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, actually, in the first year of the war, as a way of recruiting troops, he issued a kind of limited emancipation proclamation where he said, any slave of a rebel master who flees his master and comes to the side of the royal governor will automatically be freed. As a result, he formed this regiment, the Royal Ethiopians, and they actually, for a while, did very, very well in resisting the Patriot forces in the South.
Right. Well, there's a terrific book that we featured on the program about this, The Forgotten Fifth, which is these black revolutionary fighters, and blacks being a fifth of the American population at this time. And it's kind of a cynical offer, you know, to liberate the slaves. Very calculated move on the British part.
It was calculated, and yet at the same time, it's, I suppose, every bit as cynical to allow them to serve and not free them, which also did happen.
Right.
It happened on the Patriot side as well as on the British side.
So Octavian becomes a soldier with Lord Dunmore, who has his regiment wear shirts that said liberty to slaves, or actually some of them said liberty to slant, because they
were... The stitching was poor.
The shirts were made by slave women who can't read or write. Unlike Octavian, who, as we know, we learned in book one, was educated. He plays the violin. He speaks a certain way. And so in addition to now being an outcast from the white world that he ran away from, the scientists, he sort of feels initially like an outcast with these other blacks.
Yes, that's true. I mean, he's had a very eccentric upbringing because he was brought up in this College of Lucidity.
But is there any, I mean, the College of Lucidity aside, were there those kinds of culture clashes within the black regiments?
There probably were. I mean, one of the very sad things is that, of course, we have almost no record by anyone who was in one of those regiments because, by and large, they were illiterate. However, we do have evidence that there were ethnic tensions even within the African-American community at that period. You have people from different African nations who have very different ideas of conduct and battle and that kind of thing, and it does appear that there were some frictions like that at the time.
Yeah. Well, you sort of have Octavian, in a funny way, right the wrong that there's not much written history, because that's what he does. He starts to befriend his fellow soldiers and write out their stories.
Yes, and one of the things that was very important to me in working on this book was coming across the story of the Ethiopian regiment. I just found it profoundly moving because I thought, here is a regiment where everyone had a story of escape and flight and bravery and heroism, because they had to actually be there. And I felt like there is a huge tragedy that these very profoundly American stories, stories of people offering up their lives to try to achieve freedom for their people, right, that these stories would be lost. And so in a strange way, I guess one of the things I wanted to do was to reconstruct what those stories might have been like if they had been told, to produce something that really felt like it could have been the truth for many of those historical entities who who were on that, those ships and who fought in those battles.
So in a way, Octavian, in writing their stories, becomes you. You know, it's a stand-in for you, you know, who wants to tell their stories. And of course, there's the story of war. Would you do us the favor of reading a passage where Octavian, you know, again, grew up thinking he was a prince, finding he's, in fact, a slave, and now he is a soldier, this, like, mind-boggling experience he's having being thrust into war.
Sure. And so this is a scene that takes place during the Battle of Great Bridge, which, as it turned out, was a kind of a massacre because of a strategic mistake on the part of Lord Dunmore. Now it was a rout. Bullets were flung among us. I saw men collapse before me, or grab a limb and topple, rise up and stagger. I passed dead upon the bridge, men prone with their arms hung over the river. Liberty to slaves on shirts of corpses, and a man fallen in the river who bobbed there, drowning, holding up a red hand. It was, I saw, not his own. He struggled to save another.
Very dark passages here and elsewhere in the book. Different storylines appear, including Octavian learns more about his mother's passage on a slave ship from Africa. There's brutal scenes of rape. And this is a young person's book. Did you ever think, well, maybe this is a little too dark in spots?
No, I mean, I think that people in some ways underestimate what teens are ready to take on as readers. In particular, in this case, I guess because it was not a fantasy, because this was our national reality, I felt like it was very important, in fact, to be quite frank about the kinds of things that people are willing to do to each other in some of these very extreme situations. Because those are things, I guess we have to confront the fact that all of those things which our ancestors did before, we are still capable of, in a sense, now. And to say, well, so what is it that stops us from doing these things? What is it that keeps us a moral nation, which I think is tremendously important? What I'm getting down to is just, if we are asking our children to die for their country at age 18, I don't find it to be a problem to ask them to think about that by age 16.
Well, you wrote in your afterword that in doing the research for both of these books, you came across the word liberty so many times in so many different contexts that it ended up having no meaning for you. What did you mean?
Well, it's literally, you can find people arguing for liberty in the abstract, and what they are specifically asking for are two opposite things. Some people are saying, on the one hand, we need the liberty to own property as we feel fit, i.e. the liberty to own slaves. And slaves, of course, are saying, no, we need liberty, meaning we're not enslaved. So in a sense, there is this incredibly contradictory attitude. And yet, as I say in the book, even though liberty in some ways, when you read it in these different contexts, becomes meaningless, somehow it can simultaneously be meaningless and yet something that is worth dying for. I mean, when we look around the world at the atrocities of the 20th century and we see what can happen under a government that does not value liberty, the semantic question of what liberty means, in a sense, okay, you can quibble about that, but at the same time, the destruction that can be wrought is so total, I think that it definitely makes liberty a thing, in the end, that is worth dying for.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.